understanding your cultural profile just basically means that you know that there are different perspectives from yours and there are different ways to get to the right answer.
Unconventional Life, the show where I interview successful entrepreneurs, artists, creatives, and thought leaders on how they earn their living in non-traditional ways. Twice a week, we will explore how they took the path less traveled, what their revenue model looks like, and why they are prioritizing their passion over their paycheck. I'm your host, Joel Schroeder. Unconventional Life, welcome. This is your host, Joel Schroeder, tuning in from Boulder, Colorado. I've got a special guest joining us from New York, Tayo Roxon in the house. Tayo, are you ready to take us down the path less traveled?
I'm definitely ready to Robert Frost it with you. So let's go.
Amazing. So Tayo is a cross-cultural business consultant, which he helps individuals and corporations improve their bottom line through diversity, inclusion, and social justice strategies in the workplace. So he's got quite an interesting background. Originally from Nigeria, he spoke at World Bank, the United Nations Foundation, lived in 5 countries on 4 continents, and he's also the host of the podcast As Told by Nomads. So super excited to dive into everything like cultural and diversity and implicit bias and all kinds of fun stuff on this episode. Tayo, welcome to the show. Fill in any gaps I might have left out and give us a glimpse into your personal life.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's a real honor. And I know we have quite a couple of mutual friends and they all spoke highly of you. So it's an honor being your show and thank you for that lovely introduction. I don't know, talking about myself, I always hate talking about myself because we were saying this, but I usually describe myself as a walk-in contradiction. So, you know, I grew up as the oldest of 3 boys, but, you know, as a Nigerian, you know, my dad being a diplomat, essentially I was always the minority everywhere I went. You know, you mentioned how I grew up in 5 countries and 4 continents. So, you know, before I was 17, having that much change in my life, for some reason, I think it had sparked something in me. And the thing that it sparked in me was really my curiosity. I started becoming more curious about the world and how to fix it from a global point of view. And, you know, while I definitely thought about superheroes because, you know, my cousin is Superman when I was 10 years old and all that. But I would always think about, you know, sports, superheroes. But the one thing that kept me up at night was figuring out how I had a role in the global construct of things, how I played a role in globalization. So essentially, after seeing 2 failed, you know, governments in Nigeria, you know, we had 2 military dictatorships. I just started reading on Nelson Mandela and I started studying Oprah. You know, I wanted to see how Oprah connected through media. And I was very fascinated by how, you know, the late Nelson Mandela was able to bring a whole group of people together after being in prison for 27 years. I'm 27 now, so that's just some context. But how he brought a bunch of people together and formed a government in 1994. So, yeah, being fascinated by that never left me until I graduated from college. So I started interviewing people around the world. And lo and behold, people started asking me and calling me for tips and things that I had seen in my experience. And I unintentionally became this consultant to businesses and people where I was helping them improve, you know, their bottom line in the businesses in the globalized and digitalized world. So I don't know. I always say I'm a walking contradiction who sort of stumbled onto his path by following his own curiosity about the world.
Yeah, I love that. I think following your curiosity and your highest excitement can lead you down some fun rabbit holes and some interesting ones. And it seems like that's the case in your story. And, you know, I'd love to dive more into what is being a cross-cultural consultant? Like, what does that mean for someone that's listening? That's like, how do I place that? Like, what's the value of that? How does that work? Give us like the little snapshot of it.
Well, think about it this way. So what globalization has done is created new and unexpected overseas markets. You know, what globalization has done is has basically made the fact that you could be working with an Indian while you're sitting next to a Korean and a Nigerian, and you have all these workforces who are increasingly globalized, but at the same time, you have people with a reality or a perception that they've grown up with. So what that creates is possibilities for conflicts, or possibilities for progress. And a lot of times you know, people don't know how to handle change. We've seen 2016 be a direct response to people not knowing how to respond to change. So what happens is that businesses, as they're trying to expand into different market and further differentiate themselves from the competitors, they want to know what the best way it is for them to go into new market. They want to know how, if they trained the best employees to deal with the culture nuances, so you don't just go to China and think that you can close the deal immediately after having lunch. And you have to realize that that takes actually quite a series of time for you to build a relationship, or what they call guanxi, for you to actually say, okay, this person now trusts me, now we can talk about business. And it's dealing with those things like that within the global construct, and understanding that, you know, the globalization doesn't go away, but we have to be uniquely positioned to be able to tackle everything that globalization throws at us.
Yeah, I love that. And so tell me, growing up, you said, you know, you grew up in Nigeria. How was it with your dad as a diplomat? And then, I mean, I imagine you probably moved around a lot as a kid. So you probably, a lot of different continents, a lot of different cultures. What was it like growing up for you with your dad and moving around so much? That's my first question. Then I've got a follow up after that.
Well, initially, it was normal. So, like, the first move I had, I was a kid. It was when I was one. It was to Sweden and wasn't quite cognizant of it. That's where my brother was. But I do remember, you know, I've always been a hyper kid, so I would throw apples outside and yell, "Man, woman," to Swedish men and women as they walked. But it wasn't until I was 10 that I actually became cognizant of it, because that was the first time I was going to move to a French-speaking country called Burkina Faso, in an American international school, and I spoke with a very strong Nigerian accent. So you can imagine me realizing that I was going to spend the next 4.5 years there, going through puberty while dealing with figuring out how to make new friends. And it was interesting because it was initial excitement, and I was like, yes, new country, I love traveling. And then when I got there, I saw that it was a lot harder for me to make friends. In fact, I remember coming back home sometimes and my mom I was telling her that I felt inferior because everybody looked so different and they sounded so different, and they had their own cliques already. It was a very small international school. And that went on for about a week or so. And then this was the first time I really started doing investigative work. I decided to find a way to connect. I was like, I can't be this lonely guy at 10 years old. I'm naturally a hyper happy person. So what I did was I started observing the people, and I saw that a lot of the groups formed around sports. I played sports all my life, but at that point I'd only played football or soccer. Yeah, soccer, I guess now. But see, that comes back and forth to me. I'd only played soccer. So I saw that they were playing basketball and tennis. So I went to the library and read up every single thing on those two sports. You know, all the history, all the great players. And then I started reading the magazines so that I could know who the current basketball players were. And that was like a 2-week process. And I can be a very fast reader. So I, after doing that, I went to the best basketball player on campus. And I was like, hey, Michael, so I know everything about basketball. Can you teach me? This is 10 years old, 10, 11. Can you teach me how to play? And what the mindset behind that was that once he taught me, it'd be 1-on-1, become 2-on-2, then 3-on-3, and then I'll be able to, you know, be part of different people's communities. So, and that worked, luckily, but it was me having that deep desire to connect at that early age, because I felt alone, that really defined how I felt after every move. I then came back to Nigeria, and it was a completely different experience because I was then not Nigerian enough, because then I had a new accent and I played different sports. But I learned then how to become more comfortable with who I am, regardless of where I moved. And then the other move to Vietnam and the U.S., by that time I had figured out the dexterity between cultures. But you know, it's interesting back and forth.
Yeah, but, totally. I love how as a 10-year-old you were like outside. It would have been easy to be like, all right, I'm just gonna be the outsider kid, gonna be alone, whatever. And you're like, no. Looking at the situation, basketball, that's my in. You research it, you get some guy to teach you how to play it. And I imagine like that mentality of inclusion has probably, you know, in one way, shape, or form stuck with you and evolved with you throughout the course of your life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, when I'm talking to companies, it's about diversity and inclusion. And I always talk to CEOs, you know, because my main clients would be CEOs, the senior leadership, as well as the HR people. And CEOs always want innovation, right? And innovative ways to market, innovative ways to connect to their employees. And I always talk to them about how diversity drives that innovation. With HR, they want good employee relations or employee retention. And how do you do that? You have to make sure they feel inclusive. Or you have to know, how do you deal with a millennial and a Gen Xer? Have to make sure that they feel inclusive. So it's very much very, very present in everything that I do, is making sure that they are leading from a point of view where everybody's voice is heard. Sure.
Yeah, I love that. So speaking to those that might be listening, which we obviously have a huge millennial entrepreneurial type of audience, some CEOs, some, you know, wannabe or aspiring CEOs, but for those that are maybe experiencing imposter syndrome or they're feeling excluded, what advice might you give if there is a desire to actually be, you know, in more of that inclusion space? Like, what advice might you give to kind of take some steps to kind of combat or evolve that?
Well, I mean, there are a few things. One of my favorite quotes is, I guess there's a debate about who said it, but it's he who says he can and he who says he can't are both usually right. And it's not just a he or she, but the whole point is that you've got to take a gamble on yourself. I remember, I'm 27 now, and I remember, you know, I just told you I had all these vivid dreams of doing things at a global level. I was studying all these things in addition to being a kid, but I would be reading about all these diplomatic issues and trying to figure it out. But when I finally got to college, Stephanie graduated, I had applied to over 85 jobs and they all said no. I'm a foreigner in America, right? So you have to go through a certain process because there's a visa and all that. So I basically gave in to the first job. They gave me an offer because I was like, I can't keep applying if 85 people already said no. And then my time is running out because you have a limited amount of time before your visa, whatever, kicks in. So, but I remember feeling stuck because I had basically gone against everything I said I was going to do. I stayed there for 2 years, but it was a lot of me doing work in 8 hours that I could have done in 3 hours. It was me banging my head. It was me not aligning with the company mission. And a few things happened. And this is to the listener thinking that they're an imposter syndrome. I didn't take a gamble on myself because I thought I wasn't good enough and I needed more experience. So I went to the conventional route. But one thing that happened was I took a trip to New York City to watch basketball, which now is my favorite sport after learning it. And I remember feeling more alive here than I ever felt before. And it all of a sudden, it just woke up like all those missions that I've always had. But I still felt like a fake when I came back because it's like, nah, you can't do that. You're 21. And then I was driving to work 2 months later, and this car swerves into my lane and cuts into half. All of a sudden on the highway, I lose control. So I'm swinging left and right. So I hit the left guardrail, and I hit the right guardrail, and I hit the left guardrail again, and the car lifts up. I'm certain at 22, this is my death. And the only thing I said to myself that time was, I'm 22 years old, and I have not done anything that I said I was going to do. And that was so profound for me, even though I thought I was going to die at that time, that I slammed the brakes. And luckily, it was a three-car accident. My car was totaled, but I was unharmed beyond the shock. And I just took that as a sign, like, I'm gonna quit this job and move to New York City and figure it out. And that's to this person listening saying, what do I do? I didn't know what I was going to do. I just moved here, applied to an MBA program, and basically went to class at night and went and made New York City my campus and started the podcast that I now do. But it was out of necessity for me. And I didn't know what my end destination would be, but I knew that I had to be where – I had to be out of where I was currently. And I just followed what it was that I felt like I was going to do. I felt like I wanted to be in media and I wanted to tell stories about globalization. So yeah. I did that and everything just sort of fell into place. I was broke, man. It wasn't like, this is not a serious story, but it just sort of fell into place because then I was just eventually following my mission and I used that fear to start driving me. But
Yeah. What a crazy story. I literally, the moment you're like, the car swerved, I was like goosebumps. And as you kept telling, it was like more goosebumps. And by the end, it was like full body goosebumps. I've also like had crazy experiences, a legitimate near death experience and several close calls. So I definitely get those kind of wake up calls. So at the moment when you left your job, what were you doing in your typical 9-to-5 job? What kind of job was it?
It was sales. I was doing digital marketing.
Yeah.
A bunch of those.
Yeah. And I imagine when you quit your job, probably didn't have a ton of money saved up. Is that true?
No.
Yeah. But but you knew after that accident, you were like, I'm 22 years old. I got to go for it. And you just kind of went. And at that point, was entrepreneurship, was that the first time you thought about yourself as an entrepreneur or even considered, maybe at that point you didn't even think about yourself as an entrepreneur, but just considered like an entrepreneurial path? Was that kind of that turning point, or had that been alive for you before?
It's always funny. I always struggled defining myself as an entrepreneur, but it's at that point, I just knew that I was going to follow my life's mission. You know, my life's mission is use your difference to make a difference, right? I knew that I was going to live a mission-based life, and that was the most important thing for me. I wanted to be able to say, I didn't want to ever be in that position where I was near death saying I wasn't proud of the life I had lived, right? I hadn't done anything else I was going to do. And that's what drove me. And I always tell this to aspiring entrepreneurs and business owners and consultants, that what is the larger, bigger picture? You know, Simon Sinek says, what's your why? It's very similar to that. Why is it that you're doing what you're doing? And that's actually what keeps me, you know, during the tough times, because, you know, with this type of lifestyle, sometimes you never know, right? But I started thinking of it that way. And then the label entrepreneur started again being assigned to me. I think it was a few people did a story on me and it said, the entrepreneur, Tyo Roxton. And I was like, they didn't realize. but that's how it was for me. So I look at it from a mission base. And then everything else just sort of falls out.
Yeah.
Are you ready to make 2017 your best year yet? Join us for the Unconventional Life Summit, a 3-day virtual success accelerator designed to help you build your own freedom-based lifestyle. You'll learn from 20-plus world-class millennial entrepreneurs and thought leaders on their secrets behind up-leveling every area of your life and creating lasting impact. Go to unconventionallifesummit.com right now to register and claim your free spot.
So when you talk about stuff falling into place, like I've had that experience, a lot of guests that I interview on the show have that experience where you align with what it is, that mission that you're here for, and then those pieces or those actions just become clear. And so if you could kind of zoom out on what happened in the years and time after, like give us, just so we can kind of be there with you, like what specific things happened and how like might a listener here just understand, like in seeing themselves in your journey of how you went from that to kind of the success and the figure that you are now.
All right. So, you know, zooming out, I had gone to New York. I was this guy in New York City who's in love with the city, but not quite sure what he's doing, but also getting an MBA at night. And only thing I knew how to do was talk a lot. So I gravitated towards that. I listened to a lot of podcasts. I felt like, you know, Oprah's like my mom from afar. So she's done a lot of media things, and I always wanted to launch a media story to try to tell the right story. So I just did the first thing I knew, which was to talk and interview and investigate. My natural inclination is to ask questions. So I did that, and I launched a podcast. Didn't know how the first time I launched the podcast, but took a course in like a weekend, figured it out, launched it, and just left it to told my friends, hey, I'm doing a podcast, let it go. About 2 months later, it got listed as the number 2 business podcast 2014 by Entrepreneur. I was like, how do you guys even find me? So then I was like, that was like a validation type of thing. So listeners listening, you do what you know first, get, you know, gravitate towards that, and then look for validation, or if something validates you, that, you know, inspires you. So I kept doing that, and I was like, okay, so I'm getting my MBA in my first year. I've got to figure out how to turn this into a business. That included me, what some might call foolishly, actually not going to any recruiting trips in any of my MBA classes, because schools, companies would come, Deloitte, all those would come there. And I was like, no, I found my thing. Yeah. And I just didn't go to any of those jobs because I was like, those people are not doing what I want to do. I found my passion. Fast forward, Still didn't figure out I was getting paid. So it was very, 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 very lean months. And most of moments of regret thinking, should I really have ignored every single recruiter that came on campus instead of trying to make a business out of this, which I still don't know how to make a business out of. And then after, I guess, 2 more months after that, like a few months before I graduated, a company then hired me. Hey, we wanted you to come do a consultant. So I thought, yes, maybe I'm a consultant. And they fired me 2 months after. And then I was back to square one. So I was graduated, not quite have a job. I had an empire, I thought, a button empire with users I didn't know to do anything with except talk. And then I decided to launch a course because I thought that's the natural thing you do. I didn't do any research on the audience, and I felt like they would want to know what I'm teaching and what, like, 20 teachers I brought together were teaching. That also failed. So you can imagine how low I was right here. And, you know, after having 2 consecutive failures, one being fired and one not launching the course, I just, you know, went back to the basics and said, I'm going to start applying for jobs again, and I'm also going to try and work at the same time. And in the middle of that, I had a conversation with one of my mentors, and she said, this is a listener from the podcast. She said, hey, I've been listening to your show for a long time, and I just really wanted to have a 15-minute conversation with you. Would you be willing to do that? And I was like, sure, sure. And then she said, so I'm older than you, obviously. I'm like 40-something, and you talk a lot about how you found your cultural identity. I've always been looking for a piece of content that would be willing to help me with my identity, and listening to you tell your story has really inspired me. I don't know if you hear that a lot, but I wanted to tell you, I want to invest in you as a person, and please don't say no. I really, really think you've helped me. You helped me out of a really difficult time. And I would be speechless throughout this whole period. Because like I said, I was like lowest of low. Yeah. On the outside, it looked like this guy got everything together, all the followers in the world. And we just ended up building a friendship, and and after that, she ended up being like, she's a friend now. She was started up as a mentor and started telling me some of the things that I was doing, which was assuming what the market wanted by launching a course, which was being too quick and thinking that every form of success in the media translates to monetary success without doing groundwork. And it was a series of things. I started to learn more about the business of things, and that led me to actually start getting more people ask me to come in-house to tell them what I've learned. And gradually I dug myself out of the hole, and here we are today.
I love that. Yeah. I love those moments where just when you feel like you're at your rock bottom, it's like life just effortlessly throws you this bone and it's like, keep going. And for those listening, like those moments do happen. And if you stay in the game long enough, like you will have that experience yourself. So
yeah,
I love that. So let's switch over for a moment. Like, let's talk about culture and the work that you're doing in the world. And I think she had mentioned, what was the phrasing you used? The cultural profile or cultural, you just described.
So I help people build culture profiles, and and I think that's what you're saying. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Cultural profiles. That's the word. Yeah. So for our listeners, like, what does that mean, and what can we, like, where's the gold in that? Like, what can we get out of knowing our own cultural profile, and how do we actually get to know and understand it?
Well, if you, first of all, it's not a one size fits all. But if you look at the fact that you spend most of your life at work, that just means you spend most of your life with people that you come across on a daily basis. These people, with today's world, are bound to come across from different works of life, different backgrounds. And if we don't know how to deal with them, we don't know how to be better colleagues. You don't know how to have that engagement that we want to have to lead to better job satisfaction. But we also don't know how to actually market to our target audience, because if we feel like we stay in our own bubble, we then have that danger of having someone who's more innovative come in and say, well, I understood these guys, and you just stuck in your laurels. So understanding your cultural profile just basically means that you know that you're open-minded enough to know that there are different perspectives from yours, and there are different ways to get to the right answer. But it's how do you incorporate your culture with their culture to ensure that you're not, you're not being one track minded.
Yeah.
I've been in meetings when I was talking to two companies. One company said, we've always done this way. This is our 20-year model. I'm going to market this way, and this is how we're going to launch. I think you have a lot of valid points, Taya, but that's not how we've done things. So I said, okay, I'm just telling you the market here and the trend here, people here are trending this way. They like this this type of approach. They're like, nah, you know, we have our name and industry for this. And lo and behold, 6 months later, you know, I got a phone call saying our first launch was this, and it turned out to be a disaster because nobody knew what we were talking about. And that's those are the type of issues that I'm talking about, is because you become tone deaf. I mean, it's the reason why Brexit happens. It's the reason why anything in the U.S. election happens, no matter where you stand from. It's the reason why there's a populist movement all over the world, or someone like me who's lived in two dictatorships. It's the reason why a lot of discomfort happens, because people feel like they have the answer over someone else, someone of the group, and they've come to solve it without listening to others. So I just feel like it's way more important now than it's ever been before.
Yeah.
Regardless of how you feel on any political landscape.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. So for someone listening that maybe is like, okay, Tayo, I've never considered that, and now you're offering this, like, where could they start? Like, what specific steps could they take, or specific questions could they ask themselves, or specific lenses to start to try on or consider to just engage in this kind of conversation?
So one of the first things this is the journey to being self-aware, is to ask yourself what your biases are. And to look at, really look a deep dive into your days and look at your environment. What is the demographic of your friendship makeup, your closest circle? Who are the people you interact with? Are they a certain way? And if they are a certain way, why are they that way? And if they could be, diverse, you ask yourself, well, why do I find myself gravitating towards these type of people? And doing that deep dive to find out what your deeper motivations are will start to reveal things to you, like, okay, so I think of the world this way because this is how I grew up. I only lived in Kansas all my life, and I've never seen any other type of person. So me interacting with them, I jump inadvertently. What can I do to address that? And then the next step would be start thinking of positive role models, positive influences from the people that maybe cause you to jump, right? So if for example, I've been in an elevator when I first moved into a place, and the lady clutched her purse, and she was like looking at the elevator because she had an image of a guy coming from the gym that's black, that might be aggressive. So when I talked to her, she said, well, I've only known that. That's all I've seen on TV. And every time I see a crime, it's always a black person. So then I then talked to her. I said, so can you name 2 to 5 positive black people? And she said, well, Barack Obama, Will Smith, Denzel. So, okay. So I said, fine. That's good. So that means it's possible that there are those type of positive people. She's like, well, yeah. But that's like, okay. I was like, no, that's fine. So now that you've identified as positive, how do you now focus your mind on those type of things? So I basically went to a practice with her where I was like, every time your first instinct is to react that way when you see a black person, start thinking, counter it with the positive mindset, and then ask questions. That's the third step. Ask questions about what you don't know. If it's about gay people, working with gay employees, what is it that you want to know? Make sure you ask. If it's about black or Hispanic or white or women or men or, millennials, ask the questions. And then just continue to do that as a daily practice. It's not going to happen overnight. But it's something that you have to be willing to first address as a problem.
Totally. Yeah. I love that. So I'm going to go one layer deeper on that, especially since the era, we've just had Trump being elected as president. I was fortunately in Bali in Thailand during that election, but it stirred up a lot. And I don't usually go political on the show, but we're going to go here for just a moment. So I think with all of this fear around how is Trump going to be with, immigrants and Muslims and gay people and all of it, right? Like, as millennials and as those listening to the show, by trying this specific advice on or incorporating it, what do you think could be possible by actually doing this process for ourselves in terms of healing, like the external world? Do you think it is possible? And do you think this is a gateway or like what? Yeah, I don't know if that makes sense at all.
No, first of all, it is very, it's going to be hard work. I mean, I think, so I'm a little different from you on Facebook. I'm very outspoken, so I talk about a lot of these things. So what happened was when the election came about, a lot of people started realizing like, oh my goodness, I didn't realize that this has been a reality all these years. And then you had a bunch of people saying, well, I've been trying to tell you this for a few years, and you've been saying it's just this, it's just that. So essentially what that told to me and communicated is that people haven't been listening to each other. So people have either felt like one person is throwing the race card, one person is too lenient, too liberal, too all that, or the media themselves might maybe have leaned towards another way, so you felt like it wasn't a problem. So the first step with that that process I explained is you got to ask yourself what it is that you actually don't know about, and then seek to understand. I always put myself in uncomfortable situations. I'm talking to people that disagree with me every day, constantly. But put yourself in those positions and try to have those type of conversations where if it's, as hard as it may be for me, for example, having a conversation with a Trump person where it doesn't end up being, volatile. It's like, wait, you hear his or her points, and then you get to voice out your points, and making that a daily practice. Because what's going to happen is if we don't actually start seeking to connect, and we seek to go back in our cave because we feel like we're defeated and we're going to wait for 4 years, it's only going to get worse the next time around, because more people will be empowered because they feel like this is the status quo, and since no one else has spoken up because everybody else went down in their cave, they're just going to feel like, well, this person was right, and I'm just going to teach my kids this way. So I think what we should seek to have is have more open dialogues, have more uncomfortable discussions, and make an environment of openness where no side feels attacked. And it's just going to have to be a regular thing. As hard as it is, it has to happen, because there's no other way. There's really no other way. Otherwise, if you don't speak up for the voiceless now, they're only going to be more voiceless 4 years from now.
Totally. So. Yeah. Thanks for going there with me for a minute. So last question before we jump into the rapid fire round. So I know you specialize with taking this whole conversation and connecting it to business, and then ultimately helping companies improve their bottom line as a result of utilizing this type of stuff. So for those listening, wearing their entrepreneurial hats, I know we've got some founders, some that have been at it for 5, 10+ years, and some that are just starting. How could they, at a baseline level, just start to incorporate this? And I know you've given a lot of ideas of what they can do for themselves and intermittent cultures between in their organization. But just like as a baseline level, is there a few other types of things they could connect to the bottom line specifically?
Well, I mean, if you're an employer, or it's like look at it in your hiring. Are you hiring diverse talent? Are you hiring a young person, a woman, people from different backgrounds, or that inadvertently is going to give you different perspectives and different. That's going to drive innovation no matter what you're doing. That at the very baseline, it's a high functioning team that you can create. Other base, I'm trying to think of something. basic lesson here is understanding. That level of diversity and the communication that comes with having a team like that is invariably going to affect the way you see the world. And then the other question was what else?
Here's a more specific question for you. So for those launching courses or those launching new products, I know you mentioned that you hadn't done the research before, and then having that mentor, that made a big difference for you. I imagine this conversation plays a big part in doing the research. Is that true for you? And if so, like, what can those that are just starting a new product or a course, how can they take this and maybe help them with that?
Well, you have to make sure you fully understand your intended target audience. You have to know what they want, what drives them, what keeps them up at night, right? You have to have done the research. You have to have that avatar, but you have to have that avatar being backed up with the research. When I was launching this, I asked myself the same questions, and it ended up being, what is it that keeps the HR personnel up at night? What keeps CEOs up at night? And a lot of that is employee churn. How am I keeping my employee engagement? How am I making sure that they all the practices I do include everyone in the office? How do I, and as CEO, how do I pass on leadership to a team that I'm happy about? And how do I get into an unexpected overseas market with that while being innovative and not losing the business sense? So doing those, making sure you're doing your due diligence and launching a new course is going to be key, because you're going to have to figure out if what you're launching is viable or not. So to end it, it would be this, I guess, 7 questions. What specific problem do they have, and how can you help them with that? What is it that keeps them up at night? What do they worry about? How are these problems affecting their life, their relationships, and their businesses? How do they feel about this problem? What is their attitude towards solving the problem? And is solving the problem even a priority? If so, why?
Awesome. Powerhouse stuff. Tyo Roxen, everyone. All right, Tyo, rapid fire round. You ready for it?
All right. Yeah.
All right. Ready. Question number one, fill in the blank. If you really knew me, you would know what?
I'm a hopeless romantic, and I am always looking at the best, looking for the best in others, even though it might not be beneficial to me.
I love that. Okay. Question number two, what is one practice that you do daily that you feel contributes to your success?
I have a gratitude journal, and I make sure I write down things I'm grateful for that day. So I do that. I read it every morning, and then before I go to bed at night.
Next question. If you could turn back time and give a piece of advice to your 16-year-old self, what would you say to him?
I'll tell him that you're not experiencing brokenheartedness. You haven't even experienced love yet. This is just high school crush. Nah, I would say be patient. That did happen too, but that was not a, it's not a serious, that's just a high school thing. Just be patient. I'll tell him be patient. I'm a very, very rah-rah, you know, impatient person, but I'll tell him be patient and follow your heart. It will work out.
Next question. If you could imprint one cultural nugget into any person's brain that's listening to this, like if they could just like totally internalize it, what would that be?
It's the simplest thing. I always say, ask questions. You've got to put yourself in the position where you ask questions. People hate asking questions, but the only way you're going to know an answer and not form an opinion that's dangerous is if you don't ask questions. So, and if I was going to add something else, it's travel.
Awesome. And last question, what does living an unconventional life mean to you?
Living an unconventional life means living a life on your terms and being able to say that you've achieved all that it, you've surpassed your potential. So. Yeah. That's what it is to me. I think we're living a lot of life where people define what your potential should be. But if you said you've surpassed your potential, that's unconventional. Yeah. Not many people do that.
That's awesome. All right, Tyo, tell us about the giveaway that you've got for one of our listeners to take this conversation a step further.
All right. So my giveaway is basically helping one of you develop your personal culture profile and showing you how you interact, you and your business interact with a specific country. I've understood 70 plus countries in the world, so I can help you figure out how your personal culture profile aligns with that and how it would be good for you to interact with people from those areas.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I know you don't usually do this with individuals, so it's kind of like a special treat for one of our listeners, which is so awesome. And for those listening, you can head over to unconventionallifeshow.com to get more details about that. But thanks for that, Tyo. And then for those that want to tune into your podcast, want to learn more about what you're up to in the world, and just want to stay in touch, how should they find you, get a hold of you?
Sure. First of all, thank you so much. You were a great interviewer. I've had a lot of fun. You asked great questions. You can find me at Tyo Roxen everywhere. I think I'm the only one, but tyroxen.com, Tyo Roxen, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat. And the podcast is called As Told by Nomads. And I just launched a YouTube show called Use Your Difference. So, yeah.
Amazing. And you will soon be able to find me on that show as well. So we'll do a little bit of collaboration, which is amazing as well. Well, Tyo, thank you so much for taking the time. Unconventional Life family, thank you so much for tuning in. We will talk to you all next time.
Are you ready to make 2017 your best year yet? Join us for the Unconventional Life Summit, a 3-day virtual success accelerator designed to help you build your own freedom-based lifestyle. You'll learn from 20-plus world-class millennial entrepreneurs and thought leaders on their secrets behind up-leveling every area of your life and creating lasting impact. Go to unconventionallifesummit.com right now to register and claim your free spot.